I spent the entire journey to orbit convinced that the rocket had failed and that this was what dying was like. The designers hadn't had time or budget to put in fripperies like windows or even spiele feeds. Just a fairing, a thin outer shell whose functions were to shield the Magnifique from wind blast, to block out all light, ensuring we'd make the trip in absolute darkness and ignorance, and to vibrate. The latter two functions combined to maximize the terror. Think of what you'd feel going down Whitewater in a barrel. Keeping that in mind, think of being nailed into a rickety crate and then thrown from an overpass onto an 8-lane freeway at peak traffic. Now think of putting on a padded suit and being used for stick fighting practice in the Ringing Veil. Finally, imagine having giant speakers glued to your skull and pure noise pumped into them at double the threshold for permanent hearing loss. Now, pile all of those sensations on top of each other and imagine them going on for 10 minutes. The only favorable thing I could say about it was that it was much better than how I'd spent the preceding hour, lying on my back in the dark, wedged and strapped in a fetal position, and expecting to die. Compared to that, actually dying was turning out to be a piece of cake. Most unpleasant, and in retrospect, most embarrassing, had been the philosophical musings with which I had whiled away the time. That Orlo's death and Lisa's had prepared me to accept my own. That it was good I had sent that message to Ayla. That even if I died in this cosmos, I might go on living in another. A stowaway hit me in the spine with a pipe. No, wait a second. That was the engine exploding. No, actually, it had been the explosive charges blowing off the fairing. A system of cracks split the darkness into quadrants, then expanded to crowd it out. The four pedals of the fairing fell aft, and I found myself looking down at Arb. Some of the buffeting's overtones, aero turbulence, lessened. Others, combustion chamber instability, got worse. The acceleration so far had not been a big deal compared to the buffeting. But about then it became quite intense for half a minute or so as the missile's engine concluded its burn. Made it hard to appreciate the view. Another spine crack told me that the booster had fallen off. Good riddance. It was just me and the Magnifique now. A few moments, drift and weightlessness came to a decisive end as the steering thrusters got a grip and snapped the stage into the correct orientation with a crispness that was reassuring, even if it did make some of my internal organs swap places. Then a sense of steadily building weight as the Magnifique's engine came on for its long burn. To all appearances, the sky was black. I was out of the atmosphere, and the roof of the gazebo was doing nothing more than blocking my view ahead. But as the Magnifique's engine pushed me ahead toward orbital velocity, blades of plasma grew out from the roof's edges and twitched around my shoulders and feet, just close enough to make it interesting. This was the upper atmosphere being smashed out of the way with such violence that electrons were being torn loose from atoms. At the launch site, just after I'd swallowed the big pill, an internal temperature transponder, and donned the suit, the Avowed who'd been pressed into service as launch crew had mummified me in kitchen wrap, stuffed me into the gazebo, bracing their shoulders against the soles of my feet, and strapped me together with packing tape. They had taken measurements with yardsticks, freebies from the local megastore. More tape work had ensued until they had compressed me into an envelope that matched the diagrams on their hastily printed, extensively hand-annotated documents. Then they had converged on me with cans of expanding foam insulation and foamed me into position, being sure to get the stuff between my knees and my chest, my heels and my butt, my wrists and my face. Once the foam had become rigid, someone had reached in and peeled the plastic back from my face shield so that I could see, patted me on the helmet, and stuck a box cutter into my hand. The importance of the measurements became obvious during the early minutes of the second stage burn, as I saw those jets of white-hot atmosphere playing within inches of my feet. But they faded as we climbed out of the atmosphere altogether. The entire gazebo sprang off, literally it was spring-loaded, and drifted away, leaving me as hood ornament. Then I was powerfully tempted to get free of the packing material, but I knew the velocity versus time curve of this trajectory by heart and knew I was still far from reaching orbital velocity. Most of the velocity gain was going to happen in the final part of the burn, when the Magnifique had left in its wake 3/4 or more of its mass in the form of expended propellants. The same thrust, pushing against a greatly reduced burden, would then yield acceleration that Leo had cheerfully described as near fatal.
"But it's okay," he'd said. "You'll black out before anything really bad happens to you."
I tried to look around. During the last 3 days, I had fantasized that the view would be fantastic, inspiring. I'd be able to see the other rockets going up, 200 of them, all arcing up and east on roughly parallel courses. But the suit had more airbags inside of it than Jezri had let on, and all of them had been pumped up to maximal inflation, meaning I was lying on a bed of rocks. Locking my head and torso into the attitude deemed least likely to end in death, paralysis, or organ failure. My spleen could rest easy. My eyes could see nothing but a starfield, and a bit of Arb's glowing blue atmosphere down in the lower right. Those grew blurry as my eyes began to water, and the eyeballs themselves were mashed out of shape by their own weight, like Arcibald sitting on a water balloon.